Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. This is episode number 98. Today is Saturday, June 10, 2023. A lovely, mild, and sunny morning here in Nashville. As always, thanks to Ron Trammell for our bluesy intro music. Those of us who have worked in conservation and parks for state or local agencies know very well that these agencies are often not able to move quickly to acquire or otherwise protect important properties. Budgets have to be approved by the legislature or by Congress. This alone can make it a 2 or 3 year process before authorization can be obtained. By then, a property may be lost to development, or the landowner who was once willing to sell is now disinterested or deceased. And not every property needs to be acquired in order to be protected. These days, conservation easements are often used to protect scenic areas to the benefit of the community and to the benefit of the landowner. And so, for the past 40 years or so, agencies like Tennessee State Parks or Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency have worked in cooperation with several nonprofits to assist them in making these acquisitions. Our guest today is Alice Hudson Pell. She is the executive director of the 10 Green Land Conservancy. This organization was formed in 1998 and is the oldest accredited statewide agency of its type in Tennessee. Since its formation, it has been involved in many important efforts to protect threatened land. The founder, Kathleen Williams, was a guest on the Mark Fraley Podcast in June of 2017. That was episode number 5. And recently, she was our guest on episode 96 to discuss her project to protect the Highland Rim areas of Davidson County. Today, we will learn about Alice and her organization and about some exciting projects currently ongoing. You will want to have a pen and pencil. And so I hope you will enjoy my conversation with Alice Hudson Pell. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Alice Hudson Pell, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Mark, thank you so much for having me on. I'm so grateful for an opportunity to talk with you about 10 Green and all the work we're doing.
Super. And thank you for coming out here to White Oak Drive. And you got the benefit of a little bit of a garden tour here before we got started.
Oh my goodness. What a magical, natural oasis. And of course, being able to see the little bunnies running around and all the critters here that you're creating habitat for.
We're pretty lucky here on a beautiful sunny day here in Nashville. Alice, thank you for agreeing to talk with us. It was about 5 years ago that I sat down with your predecessor, or one of your predecessors, my friend Kathleen, and talked. And she had just at that time been given the Conservationist of the Year Award by the Tennessee Wildlife Federation. And I took the opportunity to grab her and sit down and talk with her. She's inspirational. And so thank you for coming on and kind of closing the loop in that way. Congratulations to you on your promotion to be executive director of your organization.
Thank you. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to be able to take 10 Green to wherever we're going next.
Of course, your organization was first started as the Tennessee Parks and Greenways Foundation, and some people may know it by that name. And then a few years ago, you sort of rebranded and now call it 10 Green.
Yes. What we found was that Tennessee Parks and Greenways Foundation, the word parks didn't really resonate with us. We helped to acquire land for parks, but we don't manage it. And so, folks, we would get a lot of phone calls from people who wanted to book the pavilion at Centennial for their wedding or other things like that. And then Greenways has really, especially in Nashville, the meaning of the word has changed since 1994. And greenway used to mean a very long, large corridor of protected open space. And now when I think of the greenway, I think of paved paths that help transport people around the city.
Okay.
I always joke that I think that the happiest person when we rebranded was Amy Crownover with Greenways for Nashville. I think she was just thrilled that we took the name out of that word out of our name. And then the other word being foundation, we are not a foundation. We are a small nonprofit. And so sort of the implication that we had a lot of funds available. Of the four words in our former title, really only one rang true, and that was Tennessee.
Okay.
We also had an issue with just a lot of different nicknames, and Ten Green was one of our nicknames. And so we decided to keep the momentum of that name, keep the brand identity that had been associated with Ten Green, but maybe more clearly explain what we do by the shift to Land Conservancy. So we're thrilled with our branding, and I hope I never have to go through that process again.
Well, thanks for explaining that. That does help. So one of the things that I like to do in this podcast is talk with people who are involved in the conservation, parks, recreation field. And it's always a start is to learn about you and how you got started in that field. What was your inspiration to being involved with it? Now, I know a little bit about you, and I know you have not come to that sort of naturally. So tell us about how that's come to pass.
Yeah, I love this question, and I don't love my answer, but it's the honest one, and it's the authentic one. I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta. I had a long commute every day. We really didn't spend a lot of time outside. And my background is in fundraising for nonprofits and strategic planning and strategic marketing and elements like that, what we call institutional advancement. And so I have worked in different kinds of nonprofits, helping them raise money and increase their profile for years. And in 2011, I went to the Land Trust for Tennessee and was working for them for a couple years before I came to Ten Green. And I was the director of development. And when I came to Ten Green, Kathleen was going to convert me, hell or high water, and we just started going all throughout the state of Tennessee. One of my fondest memories was going to Brady Mountain, one of Ten Green's early projects, and we were hiking up this very muddy hill for what seemed like forever. And I don't think we made it quite to the overlook before we gave up because of the mud. But all the way back down, she held my hand and told me about every flower, every leaf, everything on every... So all the way up, she's explaining everything. And all the way back down, she's quizzing me on everything she taught me all the way up there. But I think that my inclination towards conservation, which really has come from visiting the places that we protected, the places we are yet to protect... just learning and studying and discovering all the knowledge out there and meeting these landowners who are so knowledgeable and who do have such incredible compassion for their land has really converted me into a proverbial tree hugger. And I love getting out. Now, after we leave here today, I'm on my way down to go kayak the Ocoee. And I'm so excited. So it's just another beautiful part of our incredible state. And I'm going to get to see it by raft with a bunch of great folks. And I'm thrilled about it. So that's a very roundabout way to say that I am a nature newbie. I'm still a nature newbie.
So your training, though, is in business administration or something of that nature?
I have a master's of education in higher education administration with an emphasis in institutional advancement.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's where the fundraising part of it comes in.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Well, your organization, and I encourage people to find your organization's website and their social media profiles. I know that you have you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, all those, I guess Instagram.
Oh yes.
And so I encourage people to check those things out because there's always something new coming in the feed there about new projects and that sort of thing. The one question that I have for you to let the audience in on is a little bit about how your organization selects projects to be involved in. I know that from my past history, I know that there are committees that work within the Department of Conservation and Environment, and there's committees that work at wildlife and other organizations where botanists come together with field biologists and archaeologists and all the people that want to advance particular projects. Talk a little bit about how that works today.
Absolutely. Yeah. So traditionally, we find land conservation projects one of two ways. Okay. An agency, whether it be state parks, state natural areas, National Park Service, or partner groups like Citizens for Wilderness Planning, Conservation Fund, Wolf River Conservancy, they will come to us and they will say, you know, we found this property, it has conservation value. Let's go see if we can conserve it, either get it into our hands, if it's like a natural area, state natural areas, for example, has a big initiative right now of Cedars of Lebanon. And so they say, hey, we really want to focus on this area. The other thing, sometimes we find projects just by jumping on Zillow or a volunteer who's in the field, especially in the more rural communities. They will know of a sign being put up or a piece of property for sale, and then they contact us. And then our goal is to find an entity that will hold it long term if it's an acquisition. So especially if it is adjacent to a state forest or a state park, I'm going to see if that program wants that property, or if we can negotiate with the landowner to do a private conservation project, a conservation easement. Then that easement actually doesn't transfer ownership in any sort of way. That easement just protects the conservation values on the land with the landowner still in control and ownership of their property. So we do have a committee structure. All of our projects have to be vetted through our conservation committee, which is similar to what you're describing. We have birders and attorneys and cavers and all kinds of experts on that committee. So they weigh in, they ensure that one, there are conservation values worthy of protection, and two, that the conservation mechanism that we're choosing, especially if it's a conservation easement, that when we're building out the restrictions that we're putting on the land, that it will both protect those high conservation values and most importantly be something that Tin Green can ensure that we are able to follow through on in perpetuity, which is one of the best and wildest and craziest parts of our mission, is that these easements are forever.
Right.
And so we have to make sure that 200 years from now, we can indeed restrict whatever it is we say we're restricting on that property.
Let's unpack that just a little bit and break it down. Having worked in state government, and let's use Cedars of Lebanon as an example. It would come to the attention of the park manager there, hypothetically, that a particular property was going to be sold, or the particular property was going to be made into a stone quarry, be mined or something to ruin it, or a subdivision was going to be built there. And hey, don't we need to buy this land so as to mitigate the impact that it would have on the park or to preserve something feature of that particular property. And state government, federal government, whichever, is just not equipped to just go out there the next day or the next 6 months from then and go talk to the landowner and get that thing sealed down. Because it's not in the budget. We work on a five-year budget plan, etc. And it has to go to the building commission to be approved. I mean, there's all kinds of things that have to be done in order for state government to move on something like that. So there's the need for organizations like yours to... So tell us about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is correct. There's a couple of reasons that the slowness of the wheels of government obviously can affect being able to purchase land, especially when it's on the open market.
Right.
Also, agencies are not allowed to go to auction. So our friends at TWRA and at State Parks, we have purchased items, properties at auction on their behalf in the past. And then, like, we've got this fascinating project that we're working on right now. It's a partnership project with National Park Service and the Tennessee Citizens for Wilderness Planning. And the National Park Service at the moment has a lot of flexibility and a lot of cash available to make purchases. But they have to be within the jurisdictional boundary of that park service. Right. So there's a very funky looking piece of property. And I can't say too much about it. It's kind of divided into thirds. A top third is farmland. There's homes on it. There's a barn or two on the property. The second third is forested outside of the jurisdictional boundary. And then the bottom third along a beautiful, beautiful river is part of the jurisdictional boundary. The family is not able or willing to sell the piece, just the lower half. So what Ten Green and the Citizens for Wilderness Planning and our partners, what we're planning on doing, and we've got a contract, is to purchase the whole thing in its entirety. Then we will sell the lower half to the National Park Service. And then our hope, our fingers are crossed, that what we can do is donate the additional lands to the National Park Service. They can accept a donation of land outside their boundary, but they cannot pay for land outside their boundary.
Oh my goodness.
And then we're hoping that, again, the top third will be able to sell off to someone to just have a home. Maybe it's conserved, maybe it's not conserved, but that would be really prime real estate right next to the beautiful national park. So it would not be possible at all for that park service to be able to acquire those properties if we were not able to jump in from a nonprofit standpoint.
Sort of as a middleman, so to speak.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about the jurisdictional boundary. And people may not know this generally out there, but you know, the national parks, the national forests, all have declared boundaries. And within those boundaries, there still are in holdings where people live and have private property, but because that property is within that boundary, then it's eligible to be acquired at some point when it becomes available or it's convenient to the service. So I often wished that our Tennessee parks and forests had a similar declared boundary. And we talked a great deal about that back in my day. We called it defendable boundaries. Often our parks, what the situation adjacent to a park is difficult, whether there's a subdivision next to. The example I always use was at Cumberland Mountain State Park, where our neighbor developed a go-kart racetrack right next to the campground of the park. And so when you can't manage your boundaries, you sometimes have difficulties.
Yes.
Knowing Kathleen, you know, part of her idea when your organization was created was to help the state parks deal with that kind of issue.
Very much so. So that is one of our big initiatives right now for the Cedars of Lebanon area. The state natural areas, Roger McCoy and some of the forestry groups have come to us because cedar glades are endemic to Tennessee. They have endangered species on them and various, you can't tell that they're special, but they're incredibly special. And so a lot of people use them as dumping grounds. They just don't know. So our goal for Cedars of Lebanon and some of the other cedar glade properties are to seek out landowners to acquire properties. We've expanded the Cedars of Lebanon by about 20 acres, and we've got a couple more things I can't talk about right now in the works. And then to work with the landowners that maybe they don't want to sell their land, but they would consider a conservation easement around the park boundaries. So at least we know that there won't be a ton of invasive species encroaching on the property, or far worse, trash, pollution, chemicals, all of those kinds of things.
Tell us, what is a conservation easement?
Okay, so a conservation easement is a legal binding document that stays on a person's property in perpetuity. And so there are really three key things that a conservation easement can prohibit. And every easement is tailored to the donor's wishes, or sometimes we've started purchasing these values. So all of them are a little bit different. But primarily, the three things are resource extraction. So whether that be mining or mineral extraction or timbering. Some easements say you can never chop down a tree. Some say you can take out invasive species, but that's it. Some say you can have you can timber your property, but it has to be done by a sustainable forestry management plan. Mm-hmm. So resource extraction. Another one is subdivision. We can limit the number of subdivisions allowed on a property. That way, if you've got a 200-acre farm, it will never end up being 400 half-acre lots. You could probably subdivide it maybe once. That's what we're going to allow, as long as, again, it doesn't affect...
Or create the minimum number of acres per subdivision.
Yes. Right. And that way, you know, but we do it tailored to the conservation values of the land. We're not going to allow you to ruin an important water source or, you know, if there's a species found on the property, we're going to ensure first and foremost that those are protected. And then the third thing in the bundle of sticks, as they call it, is the ability to build and develop on the property. Mm-hmm. And so you may have a 200-acre farm and there's already a house and a barn built. We may allow you a 2-acre inholding or some other place where you could someday build something. We may put some height restrictions on there, and we may limit where on the property it can be. Of course, we don't want to disrupt if there's water, if there's flora and fauna, whatever the conservation values are. Again, they're very, very tailorable to everyone. But those are the three primary things: subdividing, building, and extraction. And then it's 10 Green's property. Like, those are the rights that 10 Green now has. We own these rights, whether it's donated or purchased.
And it remains the underlying property remains the property of that landowner, but absent the rights to do these certain things.
Exactly. Right, you can still, you know, if it's a farm, you can still use it as a farm. If you're using it as productive timber forest, you can keep doing that as long as it's a part of our agreement. But moreover, it just will always be as it was that day. And so the process, our conservation project manager, Kristen, who does all of our conservation easements right now, she goes out, she walks your property, she takes pictures of everything. We find all of the waypoints and all of the critical things. And we develop what's called a baseline documentation. And that usually is 100 pages to 150 pages. It's got survey plats and photos and all sorts of documents from watershed groups and other things, all this good, hearty data. And that's what we go off of year after year. And that, again, is the wildest thing about this work that we do, is that that means every year from now on, we have to put our feet on that property and compare it with the baseline
and say,
is it still like it was?
So what is the benefit to the landowner of getting involved with you all as far as a conservation easement is concerned?
That's a great question. We like to talk about peace of mind because we are not tax attorneys. So I will say again, I am not a tax attorney, but there are tax benefits. Right. There is a tax credit that landowners are eligible for that can be spent over the course of 15 years, is my understanding. And just depending on the appraised value of the conservation easement and the loss of what you're donating, mm-hmm. you can take that as a charitable credit moving forward.
So somewhere out there, there's an appraiser who's willing to put a value on that that element that this person's conveying to y'all. And that's a charitable donation.
It is.
Right.
It is.
And so it's tax deductible as a charitable donation.
Yes. And you may have heard in the news the past 6 or 7 years, there have been some bad actors out there. We are a member of the Land Trust Alliance. We are an accredited organization, and they have very recently closed the loopholes that we're allowing for that. And there are some shady appraisers sitting in jail in Fulton County, Georgia right now.
Okay.
So hopefully that's all taken care of, because it's really a great thing that the IRS put this in place, because it protects land. They didn't have to do that. This is just such an incredible tool.
Right. Well, for a landowner who is interested in conservation, and you know, wants to do something other than just donate their property to the state, or maybe this property isn't the kind of property that the state would be interested in having as a park or a forest or something, but they still want to conserve it, this is a mechanism that they can use to do that.
It is the strongest mechanism that we have.
Super. Mm-hmm. All right. Would you please tell us about things that you've got going on now? I know that you all have been involved over, you know, historically with expanding Savage Gulf and Fall Creek Falls and the Piney River Basin, all that stuff. But and people go to their website and you'll see their annual reports are posted on their website, and you'll get the details about those things. But I want to hear about what you got going on now.
Yeah, so this is a great challenge that we have right now. We have completed, Ten Green has completed 153 conservation projects in our existence, in our 25 years. It's our 25th anniversary. 50 of those have been in the past 5 years.
Goodness.
It is because we've grown our staff, we've grown our resources, and all of that has just helped us kind of catapult into the next phase. What makes it hard on me is that it was a lot easier to remember the details of all of the projects when we only had 4 or 5 going on at the same time. And I think right now we have 11 contracts out and I think 20 conservation easements in progress.
Goodness.
And I have to acknowledge, I still have... We have 3 people in our land department, so they are just rocking and rolling and killing it, and we're about to wrap up a new strategic plan, and I think that's going to say, grow your land department, get out, put your boots on the ground in these key areas. So I think there's a lot more to come. A couple of the big projects I'm very excited about. I already mentioned the one with the National Park Service. That's going to be great. I will say it's on Clear Creek, which feeds into the Obed. So it's in the Obed National Scenic. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we've got a huge project going on in, it's in Memphis, but technically it's in West Memphis, Arkansas. Okay. It's 1,500 acres of land. Ten Green and a group that we formed called the Big River Park Conservancy.
Now, wait.
Yes.
A group that you formed.
Yes.
Now tell us what you mean.
Some citizens who wanted to, had this vision and had the ability to execute it, came to us and said, we have this vision for this huge park.
Okay. In West Memphis, Arkansas.
In West Memphis, Arkansas. Okay. Right across from downtown Memphis,
gotcha.
Across the mighty
the river,
Mississippi River.
Right.
There's a brand new pedestrian bridge. Well, it's maybe been open 7 or 8 years. And you can walk across it, and this is exactly where it dumps out.
Okay.
So for years, people have been walking or cycling across it, and they get to the end, and there's nothing to do, so they come right back to downtown Memphis.
Oh.
And it's pretty amazing to be on top of one of the most important rivers in the whole wide world, flowing at a really tremendous place, because when you get down there, it's like an ocean almost.
Oh, yeah.
You've got barges going underneath you. You're walking on this pedestrian bridge. You've got the active railroad going past you. I mean, it's a very unique experience. So we formed Big River Park. We helped them get their 501c3, put together the board, because they're going to be the long-term maintenance folks for this park. And then we started raising some money. We realized we were talking about really big numbers. I think right now we're looking at about $17 million capital campaign in sum. That actually helps us unlock a lot of grants to do restoration work. So it's great. I think we've raised just over $6 million so far for this effort. And Ducks Unlimited, as a group, saw the potential of what this was going to be, and they gave $1 million to the effort, and they jumped in and have had been just a huge impact on our fundraising, as you can imagine. They're so well connected and
yeah.
respected,
yeah,
and
yeah.
their headquarters are in Memphis. And so they really saw the vision of having a living, breathing example of their work right there. So there's about 8 different owners of these properties. We purchased a couple of the parcels in foreclosure. We were able to step in really fast. That's what Ten Green can do. Negotiated with other landowners, got all of them bought into this vision, because right now that particular land is really high quality agriculture land, soybeans, corn, all of that's grown there. The river floods it every
Floodable
single
area.
Year.
Yeah.
So that's also a unique challenge to
right.
building this park, but all of the land has been purchased. All of the land is currently owned by Big River Park Conservancy, and we are just wrapping up our master plan with Richie Smith and Associates, which also, there's going to be boardwalks. We're going to restore hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land. There's going to be a wonderful pavilion that we build. That's the only thing we're building in terms of structures. It's going to be just a big old beautiful lawn, cycling trails, paths. Again, these awesome boardwalks with educational signage all around. And we're going to be able to restore nature to what it is. And what it was, right. What it was before the levees were built,
right.
Eastern Arkansas was just wetlands. And we're very excited.
There's no levee on that, on the west side of the river?
There is.
There's an existing levee.
Back in the day, okay. Before, you know, humans really came
in.
Right. All of Eastern Arkansas was wetlands, all the way to Little Rock, practically.
So the levee that's there, will that be taken down, or do we know yet?
It will not be taken down. There's a long trail for cyclists.
Along the wet levee.
On the levee. Yeah, and so this will feed right into that trail. It's about 70 miles of trail that's been built so far. So it's going to be a cyclist paradise.
Now, 70 miles of trail from where to where?
I may get this wrong. Mariana? I'm not going to get it right.
Okay.
Two cities.
Along the Mississippi.
Along the Mississippi.
Okay, wow.
With a vision that it eventually connects down to New Orleans.
Gotcha.
It's a big, grand vision.
Right.
Yeah.
It occurs to me to ask, where's the state of Arkansas in this?
Well, actually, we had talked to the state of Arkansas initially about potentially owning the property.
Right.
But
you would think that would be how it would work.
They declined.
Okay.
Because this is in Crittenden County. It's not even technically in West Memphis itself, which I will call an impoverished area.
Right.
Crittenden County's even far worse off. And so they don't have the money to manage the property. They don't have the money to accept the property. So I believe where we are in negotiations is that the state of Arkansas, whether it be the Resources Agency or the Parks Department or just generally the state, will hold the land, but Big River Park Conservancy will manage and operate the park and basically lease it from the government for $1 for 99 years.
Okay.
This is the model that Shelby Park in Memphis has. They've got about 6,000 acres of land there. And technically, I believe Shelby County owns that park, but the Shelby County Conservancy manages and does everything like that.
Yeah, that park used to be the Shelby County Penal Farm back in the day, because I remember when the prison farm was closed. And, it's 5,000 acres of beautiful farmland.
Beautiful.
And now what are we going to do? And so they created this foundation to manage that land.
Yeah. And it's an extraordinary gem that they have.
Oh,
there's bison. I mean, all kinds of, there's restaurants. And it's a wonderful amenity for Memphians.
Okay, so people in West Tennessee and around Tennessee, pay attention to what's going on in Memphis and across the river there. At West Memphis. Well, that's fantastic. Anything going up in upper East Tennessee?
That I can talk about knowledgeably. We are we've done a couple smaller acquisitions at Irwin Fish Hatchery. So talk about very East Tennessee, Northeast Tennessee. But I also had a chance to tour that facility earlier this year, and it is so cool. The history of the land, the economic impact for that city, the land that they have donated to make big parks is tremendous. But there are some properties adjacent to the hatchery that they really want to conserve just to make sure that the water quality at that particular hatchery stays the same, because it's very, very unique. In that, and I might get this wrong, it's already oxygenated mm-hmm. when it comes out. It's,
right.
It's either that or the phosphorus. So it's a very, very interesting place, and we just want to make sure that it stays that way forever. And they're turning it into a gorgeous little park. They have an apiary, and they have picnic tables and pavilions. So it's not just a place where they're breeding trout. It's a community center.
Right. People should visit Irwin, Tennessee, and Unicoi County. It's a remote place on the North Carolina border. The fish hatchery there is, the fish hatchery where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually breeds and develops fish, such as rainbow trout and those sorts of cold water freshwater fish for distribution around in their properties and throughout the eastern United States. Also, Rocky Fork State Park is there. And I think your organization had something to do with that back in the day. There was a transaction that happened between the U.S. Forest Service and the state government that I think that y'all were middlemen involved in. I may be making that up. I don't know, but
it sounds familiar. But yeah. Again, we've got a lot of projects.
And whether you were involved in it or not, Rocky Fork is a place where people should visit in Irwin, Tennessee. One of the early fish hatchery elements is now a city park in downtown Irwin. I don't know if you ever saw that little place, but it's a cute little community. You know, one thing that comes to mind about your early projects was Cummings Falls, and Beth and I were involved with that back in the day, and I remember when that all happened.
Awesome.
Tell us what's going on at Cummings Falls these days. It's now a Tennessee State Park. And
it sure is, yeah. And it's a busy one, too. I don't know much about what's going on. I know that a couple of years ago they instituted a permit process. So, you know, if you're going to go, make sure you get your permit early. But I think that's wonderful because it was being a little bit loved to death.
Right.
And, you know, it is a place where you want to be a little bit experienced when you go. You want to make sure you got the right footwear. You're not wearing flip-flops. But it is such a magnificent place. And I believe that Friends of Cummins Falls Group has done a couple of smaller acquisitions near the property. I would love to see us be able to do more to protect the headwaters of that mm-hmm. river. Mm-hmm. We have a wildlife management area, which actually is very unique because it has a conservation easement on it north. The name escapes me, which protects some of the water, but there's a lot more we can do to make sure that that water is still pristine by the time it comes over the waterfall and people are swimming and playing in it.
Right, right.
And I'm talking to Mark. I mean, you know all of these things, but I learned fairly recently a statistic that is shocking. That is 30% of Tennessee's rivers and streams cannot support life, and 40% are unsuitable for prolonged human contact.
Right.
40% of our rivers and our streams in Tennessee, which right. is just disgusting.
Right.
So I think that that is something I know Tengreen cares deeply about, is protecting our waters.
You know, you're citing statistics, and I'm sure they're accurate. You know, one of the things is that, just to give us an example here in Nashville in the Cumberland River, often the Cumberland River is very clean. Right now would be a time when it would be very clean. But when we have a large amount of rainfall, our sewer systems can't handle the action. And we get dump of raw sewage into the river. And so for a period of weeks, the river's unusable for any kind of aquatic recreation. It's a real, real problem, not just here in Nashville, but throughout the state.
Yes, and I think that I'm not a Nashville native, but I am married to one, and he told me that I think it was a 7th grade or 6th grade science project was looking at the Cumberland River and other sources, and it does seem to me like it's come a long way, and you've gotten a lot of really dedicated people. Like the Cumberland River Compact does such a good job. And its early founders, Shirley Caldwell, Patterson, and Bill Coble, and others who really like identified this as a huge problem and made it a priority.
Right.
So I don't think we're there. I think we've got a lot more to do, especially because when you think about the Cumberland River stretching all along the plateau, all the way into Kentucky. But at least we know we have people who are dedicated and working towards conserving it and who have been effective so far. We're just not quite finished.
Are you all involved with local governments as well?
Not particularly. We don't have an advocacy person on staff or really much of a focus. We like to support groups that are already doing that work. So we just signed on to be a part of the Nature Conservancy has declared Nashville an urban bird treaty city. And so we've been a part of that dialogue, and our commitment is to help conserve properties to ensure that Davidson County can continue to support the birds that we receive here.
Not as far as urban parks are concerned.
No, we've done, we are in a process right now with the Trust for Public Land to expand Lachlan Springs Park, but our role was really the, helping to fundraise, helping to kind of do marketing for the park. And then what we will do, they did the acquisition piece. We're going to place a conservation easement on it, hold it in perpetuity, and then we will be selling it at a discount to Metro Parks.
Okay.
So they chip in 50 and we're doing 50.
You do?
But it was Noel Durant and TPL that was really, you know, really engaging the city in ensuring that they want to do that. We just want to be a helpful partner.
Super.
Yeah.
What about historic properties?
You know, we have not really dipped our toes into historic properties for a specific cause. A lot of our properties are very historic, old cemeteries and some other things like that. And that is something I dream of is having a storyteller on staff, someone who's a historian who can research the properties. But, you know, I say that, but we have protected some ancient sites, and that certainly is a part of our history as well.
Tell me more.
Devil Step Hollow at the head of Sequatchie is a perfect example. I mean, it's such an incredible cave, one where chiefs and priests were buried, and there's cave art inside. That is, it's a state park, and it is under a conservation easement with Tim Green as well, which is a very unique circumstance. I can't talk about a lot, but there's a park that will be open to the public sometime in the next 4 or 5 years that has several archaeological sites on it. And when we're able to talk about that, you guys, we're going to have a big party. You got to come. And then another private conservation easement we have, it's about 1,000 acres down the Suwannee area. It has cave art on it. It has some caves where we know that people lived. So we haven't protected any Civil War sites necessarily or gone out of our way to do historic mansions or things like that.
Right.
We're really focused on flora and fauna and recreation access. But there are places that we protected that have incredible histories and incredible meaning to our society.
So how do people... hearing about what the great work that you're doing, how do people listening get involved and what can they do?
Oh my gosh, of course. Well, we just wrapped up our big fundraiser, but be on the lookout for that next year. It's called the Hikeathon, and it's just going gangbusters, and we're super proud of it, which is great, and it's too much detail to get into today. But visit us at tengreen.org. It's TENNGREEN.org. Our website's got all the details. You can sign up for our email list. And then, as you mentioned before, we're on all the socials. Our handles are TenGreen, TENNGREENLC, Land Conservancy. So everywhere we are. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're even on Reddit, even though I don't think we're supposed to be. So we're having a good time, but that's where we share important updates and histories and news and funny memes and all things Ten Green.
Super. Well, Alice, thank you so much for visiting with us today and letting us know what's going on with Ten Green.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.